I would like to first thank Tim is not here, but actually he thank him for inviting me here. And oh, sorry. You're right. Sorry. Yeah, anyway, thank you for yeah. And I would just start. I think I always like this room because of this casual seating environment. So please feel free to ask questions as I go along. I think the first thing I would like to do is to acknowledge my collaborators. This work is done in collaboration with Professor Chen Fang from IOP in Beijing, and his student, Dr. Zhida Sun, was his student when he was doing this work, but now he has moved to Princeton working with Andrew Bernerick. So he unfortunately does not have time to work on this stuff anymore. But anyway, our paper is this thing requires some programming to actually do the computation, and unfortunately we had to find someone else to do the programming, but he left us his code, so that's nice. So this is our paper on archive. Basically, what I'm trying to do is presented by this picture. So the idea is like we want to construct a space crystal symmetry protected SPT states. So idea is like imagine that you could our starting point the building block is little pieces of SPT states protected by on-site symmetries. So the idea is like imagine that you can if those states are available and if you already know how to construct those states, and imagine that you can just buy them as small pieces from a toy store, and then next thing you need to know is how to like put them together and assemble them. What I'm trying to argue is that in this way you can assemble all possible crystalline topological states by just putting those little pieces together. So here's my brief outline. I will first give a very brief introduction to SPT states. And then I will tell a simplified version of the story of how to assemble those states together to get a topological crystalline states. And then if there's still time, I will present some more details, like some more subtleties about this construction. And then I'll conclude. I think now this SPT or topological phases are quite well studied. So let me just give a very, very brief introduction to it. So the formal definition is that the SPT phases are a type of gapped phases protected by some symmetries. So the gapped bulk looks trivial in the sense that there's no anions or any fractionalized excitations in there, but still they cannot be smoothly connected to a trivial phase without closing the gap or breaking the symmetry. But it's kind of hard to detect the topological non-trivialness from the bulk. However, their topological features are like also reflected on the surface. So usually you have a symmetry protected gapless surface states. There's one exception that is in three dimensions. If you have a SPT phase in three dimensions, the surface, the 2D surface, could be gapped, but it requires a topological order and an anomalous symmetry fractionalization on the topological order. So I think the most famous example for SPT phases are free Fermion states that includes the topological insulators, topological superconductors, and mathematically, the classification is well known. It's given by some generalized cohomology theory known as the K theory. There's another setup where you can study the SPT phases that is for interacting bosonic systems. And the most famous example is the one-dimensional Houdin chain. That's an SPT phase protected either by time reversal symmetry or spin rotational symmetry. And there are some simple 2D examples like the CZX, also known as the 11 Gould state. And mathematically, they are classified by the so-called group cohomology theory. And the third and most complicated setup is to consider interacting fermionic SPT states. I think for now, people have some partial understanding of how to classify those. You could use some mathematical theory, called the Kolbotnikov theory, although I am not quite sure. I don't quite understand it, or there are some formula that allows you to partially compute the computation. There are still some subtleties that have not been fully solved yet, but in general, people know like how to classify most of them, and we know they are also described by some general cohomology theory. But I think today I'm going to mostly focus on this bosonic SPT case as an example. Although I think due to time constraints, I probably won't go into the technical details of how to do the calculation. I'm trying to stay abstract and just tell you the story. But if you are interested in like how to actually compute this, you can ask questions during the talk or maybe ask me afterwards. Like I said, I was trying to stay like abstract, and so the bottom the most basic thing I need is that actually this SPT faces form a abelian group structure. That is, you can actually add things together. There's a mathematical operation you can define between them, like by adding them together. So that's the first piece of information I need. Let me first begin an example before saying anything in general. So I think probably the first example people know about topological phases is the integer quantum Hall states. That is actually an SPT phase state protected by charge conservation symmetry, although still non-trivial after if you break charge conservation, so it's a little bit tricky. But let's say we keep the charge conservation U1 charge conservation symmetry, and this is a SPT state. So the classification is actually given by the Chern number, which is an integer number, and the possible integer quantum Hall states actually form an abelian group that's isomorphic to the group of Z, the integers. There's an operation we can call this addition here, which is basically stacking. Like if you stack one system with Chern number n with another system with Chern number m, you get a system with Chern number n plus m. There's also an inversion operation there. So for every state, there's an inverse of that state. Like in this case, the inverse of a state with the Chern number n is another state with Chern number minus n, and if you add them together, you get zero. You get so here zero means trivial state, and this plus means stacking. That means you basically just put two states on top of each other, and view them as one state. And so in general, you can always do this kind of operation to SPT phases, and there's a addition and there's an inverse. And so it forms the abelian group, which is basically can be written as either the integer group Z or this Zn group with torsion, and or it might be a summation of a direct sum of different pieces of Zs and Zns. And also another important feature is that the bulk phase and the surface state is classified by the same abelian group, so they share the same classification because of the bulk boundary correspondence. If the bulk is non-trivial, there must be a gapless edge state. So there's a one-to-one correspondence between the bulk and gapless edge. I think later I will refer to this edge state as a edge anomaly, because the bulk is non-trivial means that the edge cannot be gapped out. Like at least in 1D, it cannot be gapped out without breaking the symmetry. So that means there's some obstructions on finding a gapped symmetric state on the edge of this 2D topological state. And this obstruction or anomaly has the same classification as the bulk. That is, for example, if this N state has edge anomaly that basically represented by n number of chiral edge states, and this minus n has another anomaly, but when you add them together, the bulk becomes trivial and surface anomaly cancels out, so that means you can gap out the surface state now. So other SPT phases have similar classifications. So for example, 3D topological insulator has a Z2 classification. That means this group characterizing this classification is a Z2 group. There's a trivial state we denote by 0 and a non-trivial state denoted by 1. And if we stack two 3D TIs together, we get a trivial state. That's 1 plus 1 equals to 0. Similarly, the 1D Hodan chain also has a Z2 classification. So the rule is also 1 plus 1 equals to 0. So I think in order to understand the rest of the our story, you don't actually need to know how to compute those SPT classifications. You can just imagine that there's a computer program that can does this for you, and actually there is. And at the end of the day, it will tell you that the classification is given by Z or Zn, and all you need to know is how to add those numbers. That was basically the story of classification of on-site symmetries, and after studying that, people also want to study SPT phases protected by crystal symmetries. I think one of the motivations is that in solids, we often have solids usually form crystals, so it's very natural to have crystal symmetries. So I think it was first started by Liang Fu in the context of studying topological crystalline insulators, and this idea was later generalized to study crystal SPT phases. One could say that this work is more or less done actually by Dominic and Ryan in a work where they proposed this crystalline equivalence principle, which is basically saying that if you want to compute the classification for crystalline SPD phases, you can just treat the crystalline symmetry as on-site symmetries with some twist. And the rule is like if the space group symmetry is reverses space and time, like if it's a mirror symmetry, you should treat it as an anti-unit symmetry, like a time reversal symmetry. And there's also, for fermionic systems, there's also some twist on the group extension. Like if a mirror square equals to plus 1, that corresponds to a time reversal square equals to minus 1 in a fermionic system. But today, I'm just going to talk about the bosonic system, so I don't have to worry about the second part. And there was also some other understandings, I think first pioneered by Liang Fu and McHenry. I heard Liang knows about this even when he first studied the topological crystalline insulators. So the idea was like you could stack up a lower dimensional SPT phase to construct crystalline SPT phases in higher dimensions. For example, if you have a three-dimensional system with a mirror symmetry, this mirror symmetry would define a mirror plane in the 3D system, and you could put a 2D SPT phase on the mirror plane, and that will become a 3D mirror SPT phase. Or if you have a translation symmetry, you could stack an infinite number of 2D SPT phases, and that will become a 3D SPT phase protected by the translation symmetry. I think people, this is known as a weak SPT phase, because if you stack infinite number of topological insulator, 2D topological insulators, this will become this will be known as a weak 3D TI, which is protected by both the charge conservation time reversal plus this translation symmetries. And later there was a more systematic study of free fermion SPT space group SPT phases using so-called patch constructions, and the thing we want to do here is to try to generalize to all possible bosonic SPT phases protected by all possible symmetry groups. And later I will show that the story was like we. I found a theorem in a mathematical book basically saying that this is this works for all the bosonic SPT phases for arbitrary symmetry groups, and we were trying to translate it into a physical construction. So at the end of the day, I'm going to give you some references that basically shows you that all crystalline SPT phases can be constructed in this way. So that's the motivation. And here is our construction. So in order to do this, the first thing we do is like we divide the space into smaller pieces. In this way, you'll see at the end of the day, by doing this, we can get rid of all the space group symmetries and convert them to on-site symmetries in some sense. So the idea is that, for example, if we have a space group symmetry, we cut the space into smaller pieces. So, for example, we choose the so-called what is the name? So it's like the unit cell, it's like we choose the unit cell of the three-dimensional state as the what they call the three cells. That's like a three-dimensional cell of this space decomposition, and we choose the faces of three cells as the two-dimensional building blocks, which is known as the two cells in mathematics, as the 2D blocks, and the edges as 1D blocks, and points as zero-dimensional blocks. So the rule is that we want to make sure that, first of all, the space group would map one cell to another cell. It's not okay. So for example, if there's a two cell here, a space group operation would map it to another two cell. It's not allowed if this one is mapped to two pieces. Like this one piece have to stay in one piece after the space group operation. That also implies that so some of the cells, like this two cell could be a mirror plane, or this one cell could be a rotation center and things like that. And another thing is that once this is satisfied for any cells, we denote this cell by sigma. So for any cell or this block sigma, this could be a three cell or two cell or one cell. We can define a subgroup of this total symmetry group G that maps sigma to itself. This is like the point group symmetry of this cell sigma, or mathematically is known as the stabilizer group of this cell sigma. And we want to make sure that we want our decomposition to satisfy that all the symmetry operations in G sigma acts pointwise, like acts as on-site symmetry on sigma itself. So to give an example, this is actually a wrong decomposition. So here is a two cell with a square shape that has a square shape, and there's a C2 rotation. So in this setup, this C2 rotation maps this two cell to itself. So it actually belongs to this subgroup G sigma, but it's not a pointwise action. So we don't allow this. The reason we don't allow this is that now when you look at this two cell, we still have a space group operation that's a rotational symmetry. And we imagine that we don't know how to deal with rotation symmetry or any space group symmetry. We assume that we only know how to deal with on-site symmetries. So the way we deal with it is that we cut the cell into two pieces. Now the C2 symmetry would map the right piece into the right half into the left half, and vice versa. So this C2 symmetry is no longer belongs to this G sigma for these two cells. And then on this edge between the two cells, we again cut it into two pieces, the upper half and the lower half. And C2 would map the upper half to the lower half. So C2 is, again, not a part of a stabilizer group of these two one cells. And at the end of the day, at this C2 center, the C2 rotation maps the C2 center to itself. So it's part of the stabilizer group, but this C2 rotation is an on-site symmetry on this C2 center, so that's okay. So there's actually a mathematical theorem, although I don't know how to prove it, which says that you can always do this, like if you're willing to cut it into a fine enough decomposition, you can always achieve this. And in this way, we convert all the space group symmetries to unsized symmetries on each cell. So if we only look at one cell, there's only unsized symmetries, and we know how to classify the SBTs protected by those unsized symmetries. Okay. So now the yeah.
This decomposition, I guess, is not unique.
Yes, it's not unique.
Of course, the answer doesn't change.
Yes, yes. There's a mathematical theorem says that, like, the answer does not depend on the decomposition you choose.
The answer of the classification.
Yes, yes. Like, if you do everything properly, like I'll say more about how to actually do this calculation. It's not a it's kind of complicated, but at the end of the day, when you put all the answers together, you should get the same result, like regardless of how you decompose the space.
And now there are only two rules for dividing the space into gamma cells. These are the two rules.
Yes, yes. Sorry, I guess there are maybe I'm not a mathematician. There are probably more rules. I'm not 100% sure. I think another rule is that every cell has to be contractible. You are not allowed to use a circle with a hole as a cell. There are probably some other things. I was not very careful about doing this, but I think these are the two most important rules. I think so mathematically, what we need is first we need it to be what is called a CW complex, which is basically saying that we decompose the space into like two-dimensional, one-dimensional, three-dimensional, 2D, 1D, and 0D cells, and each cell has to be isomorphic, each cell can be deformed to a disk or a 3D ball or 2D disk or 1D segment. So each cell has to be topologically trivial by itself, and you have to screw them nicely. And on top of that, there are two additional requirements that each cell has to be kept to map to a unique cell after a space group operation. And also, we also require this stabilizer group to be on site.
I'm still missing one thing. So which principle requires you to do this decomposition?
Yeah, it's the last one.
Rather than just taking the whole thing.
Yeah, it's the last one. I want all the stabilizer group to be on-site symmetries.
Of which cell?
For each cell, for each cell I can define a stabilizer group like this. And I want all the operation, all the symmetries in it to be on-site symmetries. So this is not okay because C2 is an element of this stabilizer group because it maps the cell to itself. But it's still a space group operation on this cell. So I don't allow that. Actually, you can still, this general contraction still allows it, but it's just I'm assuming that I don't know anything about space group classification. So if I had this, I can't compute the classification on this two cell. So I'm imagining that I don't know how to do it, so I don't allow it. But
so the way to conduct the cells is such that all the cells are either mapped to somewhere else,
yeah.
Or if it's not mapped to somewhere else, then the symmetry acts as an
onset. Exactly. Yeah, that's actually a better way to put it in words. Yes. Yeah, and the purpose we are the reason we are doing this is that after we divide the whole space into those cells, we want to put SPT faces on those cells protected by the stabilizer group or the point group symmetry of that cell. So idea is that on a P cell, that means a cell in P dimensions, like a three cell is a three dimensional cell, etc. On a P dimensional cell, we want to put the SPT states protected by the stabilizer group, so that classification is given by this group cohomology. If you don't know what that is, basically that's just a Abelian group, as I said before. And there's a program that allows you to compute this. And we will so on each cell we would put an SBT state, which is basically just a number from this abelian group, and we will denote it by omega hat as sigma. So omega hat is like a decoration pattern, and sigma is the component of the decoration pattern on this particular cell, sigma. And so in general, we could decorate 3D SBT on three cells, 2D SBT on two cells, 1D SBT on one cell, etc. So please allow me to introduce a notation. So here, I will write this decoration by EPP. So there's an infinity sign. I will explain what it is. So this infinity sign basically means it's the real answer. So I'm going to compute it using what is called a spectral sequence in mathematics. But roughly speaking, it's like a perturbation theory. So we are computing some answers, and we are getting more and more accurate, like order by order. I will explain what this order by order means. But this infinity label basically basically means that it's the true answer at the end of the day. So after all the calculations, we would get there. This infinity means that it's the final answer. And this lower P means it's a decoration on p-dimensional cells. And the upper P is a means it's a decoration of p-dimensional SPD phase. So this is actually a physical decoration. That means you decorate p-dimensional SPD phases on p-dimensional cells. This seems redundant as I'm writing this P twice. But later, I will argue that it makes sense to consider decorations that has a dimensional mismatch. Like I could consider decorating p plus one dimensional SPT phases on P cells, and or P minus one decorations on P cells. I'll explain what that means later. But anyway, right? So that's a general decoration, just imagine that we can do this. And at the end of the day, the final answer is a summation of all the decorations. Like we could have a 3D decoration, 2D decoration, 1D decoration, and 0D decoration, and we just at the end of the day, we just add all these answers together to get the final answer for the full classification of topological crystalline states. So that's the general idea.
So
Yes, yes. So I think I didn't write. I should have written it down. The most general setup is that you have some it's a group extension problem that you have some unsized symmetry, and this is a total symmetry group. The quotient of unsized symmetry, the quotient of total symmetry group with the if you quotient the unsized symmetry, you get a space group symmetry. So that's the most general setup we can deal with. So the simple cases are maybe you have a unsized symmetry direct product with some space group symmetry, but we can also deal with a natural extension. So. Yeah, that's why I didn't write it down as a direct product, so we could deal with some more general cases.
Sorry, in this construction, if I think about reflection,
yes,
the zero plane,
yeah,
well, that one is that U1 or U1T?
Yeah, that's a very good question. If you in this let me go back slightly in this setup. In their crystalline equivalence principle, it should be U1T in the sense that so here the coefficient is U1PT. That means mirror also acts as anti-unitary symmetry. But in our setup, like when we decorate something on the mirror plane, it should be the coefficient should be U1T. That means the mirror symmetry acts as a unitary symmetry. This makes sense physically because if you think about it, the mirror symmetry is now an unsized symmetry on the mirror plane. So it should be treated as an unsized Z2 symmetry. And that's actually what happens to the mirror SPT or mirror TCIs. Like, I think so Liang had this result of Z8 classification for 3D mirror SPTs. And the Z4 generator is actually a bosonic state. And that's obtained by decorating a 2D Levengoor CZX state on the mirror plane. And that state is calculated if you have Z2 as a unitary symmetry.
But somehow the complex conjugation structure should emerge once you...
Yeah. So if you are like think about it in physical terms, then these are two different computations, which just happens to give the same answer. Like, but if you really want a mathematical proof, I could stretch it, sketch it at the end. There's a place where this coefficient changes magically. Let's see if there's time. I'll get to that. But physically, we know that the answer should be the same. Right. So the idea is like we just put SPT faces on different cells, and let me state some consistency conditions that those decorations should satisfy. So the easiest and the most obvious thing is the symmetry condition. That is, if the two cells are related by some symmetry, then we should have the same decoration, right? Otherwise, it obviously breaks the symmetry. For example, if this piece has turn number one, this piece better also has turn number one. So that's the idea. But there's a slight subtlety here, which I will probably not go into the details. That is, actually, the two symmetry group, technically, the two symmetry groups are not the same. Like the two stabilizer groups, G sigma and G sigma prime, they are not the same. But they are isomorphic to each other, given by this conjugation operation of this symmetry operation G that maps this to that. So actually, the group cohomology calculation, which gives the classification on this cell and this cell, are not exactly the same. But they should be isomorphic because the two symmetry groups are isomorphic. So actually, the two cohomology groups are related by this isomorphism that is induced by this group isomorphism. And I won't go into the details, but there's a well-defined mathematical procedure that allows you to actually compute this on a co-chain level. So I will just denote it by this G action, like G dot this co-chain. That means this will map this co-chain, which is the element of this, to another co-chain, to the corresponding co-chain, which is the element of that. So one nice thing about this is that after this, then we know only the decorations on symmetry unrelated cells are independent, because if the two cells are related, then whatever you do here, you have to do the corresponding thing over there. So that means you only need to enumerate different possible decorations on symmetry unrelated cells. But after you quotient the space group operation, especially the translation symmetry operation, you started with an infinite space, but you end up with a finite number of orbits of those cells under the space group operation. So there's only a finite number of choices. That basically tells you that this the calculation can be done in a finite amount of time. So we can rest assured that this is a finite calculation that can be carried out on a computer. I'm going to describe the next level of consistency checks, which we call the mathematicians call the first page calculation. So somehow it's like a perturbation theory, like we are calculating things order by order, but mathematicians call this perturbation order as pages in some books. There's some very complicated mathematical table that represents this calculation. It's so complicated that each table will occupy a page. So that's one of the reasons why they call it pages. But anyway, so after this consideration, we arrive at what the mathematicians say as a first page results, which is basically just some random arbitrary collection of decorations on each cell, which is consistent with the symmetry condition. So that means we only need to enumerate different combinations on symmetry unrelated cells. So here's some more notation here. So I denote this space group decoration decomposition by a what mathematically known as a CW complex, which I denote by Y. So Y is this topological space. And this Y sub P represents the collection of cells in P dimensions. So it's like Y1 is the collection of one cells, Y2 is the collection of two cells, etc. And if I quotient by G, because only the symmetry unrelated cells are independent, so I only need to enumerate representatives in the symmetry orbits. So that's the representatives are elements of this quotient space, YP quotient G. And for each cell sigma, I gather the operations in the local stabilizer group G sigma and compute the group cohomology with respect to G sigma. And then I add them together. This forms a symmetric decoration on these P cells. And that's my p-dimensional decoration, EPP. So EPP. So here one means the first page approximation. As I go on, this approximation level will go up, and that means more and more accurate answers. Right. So like I said, later we'll generalize this to arbitrary decorations. I could decorate a q-dimensional SPD phase on p-dimensional cells, where p and q can be arbitrary. This does not necessarily have physical meanings, but I could always do that. We'll see what that means later. So now I will describe the second page calculation, which you probably already guessed that the previous consideration is very rough and it's not the accurate answer. So one consistency we need to check is that if we decorate some SPT states, for example, on this two cell, it will have a gapless edge state or some edge anomaly. And the idea is that if I have decorations on all the two cells, the edge anomaly better cancel out on this one cell. Otherwise, if there's some symmetry anomaly on this one cell, that means I cannot gap out the edge state on the one cell. That means I cannot form a consistent three-dimensional gap symmetric construct state, because in order for the whole thing to be a 3D SPT state, I need to gap out everywhere, not just on the two cells, but also on the one cells and zero cells. So those edge states better cancel out. And this calculation is what we call the no open edge condition. That means basically means all the open edges have to be closed or cancel out. So naively, what you would do is that remember that the boundary anomaly and bulk classification are given by the same group of elements. So I just take the decoration on each of the neighboring cells and just add them together. This will give me this will give us the anomaly on this one cell, and the summation should be zero to indicate that the anomaly cancels out on this one cell. But there's some subtlety here. The subtlety is that often this one cell has higher symmetry than the surrounding two cells. For example, if this one cell is a C4 rotation center, then the C4 rotation will rotate those four two cells. So that means neither of the two cells have C4 rotation symmetry. But this one cell would have a C4 rotation symmetry. So actually, the anomaly here is classified by the group cohomology involving this C4 rotation symmetry. But the SPD decoration on the two cells are classified by the group cohomology without this C4 rotation symmetry. So there seems to be a mismatch between the cohomology classification on the two cells and the one cell. So mathematically, there's a operation in group cohomology called the transfer map that allows you to transfer the decoration on the two cells to the anomaly on the one cells. So I won't describe the details, but the idea is very simple. You can think about these as some states or anomalies that are only symmetric or invariant under the stabilizer groups sigma on the sigma. So for example, if the sigma has some on-side symmetry, so these are only symmetric under the on-side symmetry, but each of them is not symmetric under the C4 rotation. But now we are adding four of them together. So if this one is not C4 symmetric, but we know according to the symmetric condition, this one should go to the sigma one should go to sigma two under the C4 rotation. So this decoration will become this under C4, this will become this, this will become this, and this will become this. So it's like you are adding a four symmetry related terms together, and it's like a symmetrization operation. And after you add them together, you automatically get a cohomology class that's invariant under the C4 rotation symmetry. So this symmetric symmetrization operation is precisely this transfer map that's defined in group called Mardy theory, and there's a well-defined procedure that allows you to actually carry out this calculation, and this will map the decoration on the two cell to a boundary anomaly on the one cell. So at the end of the day, we have an operation which we call this partial. So this partial basically takes the decoration on the two cells and map it to the and transfer it to the boundary, to its boundary. So if you think about it, this D1 operation is actually a map from a p-dimensional decoration on p cells to a p-dimensional decoration on p minus one cells. So on the so this p stays the same. That means the cohomology class is the same mathematical objects, but they have different meanings on different dimension cells with different dimensions. So on p cells, they represent a SPT cohomology class, or they represent an SPT state, and on its boundary, it represents a symmetry anomaly. So here, this operation is computes the boundary anomaly from a Bok decoration, and here this p minus one actually means a decoration of anomalies, symmetry anomalies on p dimension. P minus one dimensional cells, so that's why we call it an anomaly pattern. And this D1 map basically maps a decoration pattern to an anomaly pattern, and this map gives us the no open edge condition. That is, we need to write down a program to compute this D1 map and check that D1 omega hat should be equal to zero. That means all the 1D edges can be sealed off by some gap state. There's another thing called the yeah.
So omega hat in this figure, omega hat is a three-cycle.
It's a omega hat is a decoration of three cocycles on all the two cells. So and we would associate each two cell with a three cocycle.
Now add four of them together is
yes.
Three cocycles.
Exactly.
Now I define d omega hat. So let me call d omega hat dx hat. So x is a two cocycle.
Sorry.
X is a two cocycle chain.
Well, what is x? What is the x? Oh, you mean this d omega hat? You want to?
First equation, I want to call omega. So on the left hand side, I want to call the omega x. Because that's not
that's
D1 maps a three cocycle to a three cocycle.
Yes, yes. It just maps three cocycle on two cells to a three cocycles on one cell. So this notation could be confusing at first, but this partial and this D1 does not operate on the cohomology levels. It only operates on the spatial dimensions. Yeah, so here partial means operation on spatial dimensions, but not on the cohomology dimensions. This D1 is something different, I will explain later. But.
So how should I understand that D1 omega equal to zero means no open edge?
So D1 omega, so this is like a collection of three cells. It's like collection of three cocycles associated with each one cell. So this is like a vector equation. You should break it into components. This means on each one cell tau, I should have a D1 omega hat tau equals to zero.
What does this mean?
Because on each one cell tau, this D1 omega hat of tau is the summation of the cohomology classes on the two cells surrounding it. So that's basically the summation of the boundary anomaly on this one cell.
And the enlargement of the symmetry is already considered because it's symmetrization.
Right. Oh, sorry, it's a typo. It should be with a hat.
Then what is the difference between the cycle equation and the first equation of open edge condition?
They are the same, but. This D1 is a more general notation in in spectral sequence theory. So I'm just so this is actually saying that this D1 is nothing but partial. But later, I think, yeah, I should have time, but later I will introduce D2 and D3, et cetera. So they will have different meanings.
Then it's actually the same as the naive equation you call for last page, right? The naive equation is that it's
yes, equal yeah.
zero.
Yes, yes, and yes. It's just that.
Temper,
yeah. Yes, yes. I'm just introducing some fancy notations, which will be useful later. Okay, there's another thing called a bubbling equivalence. That is, not all the decorations are non-trivial SPT states. Sorry, this color seems to be a little bit faint, but here is actually a blue cube inside of a large white cube. So imagine that we have a three cell that's represented by this large cube. And in the middle of the three cell, we create a bubble of a two-dimensional SPT faces that covers the size of a tiny cube. So this is a SPT face on a closed sphere. So there's no gapless edge states. So the whole thing is gap and symmetric. And so this process of creating this bubble out of the vacuum is actually a smooth deformation of the state, which does not change the SPT classification of the whole thing. And now I'm going to make this larger. And larger, and then make it fill the whole three cell. So the result of this smooth deformation process is that I'm changing the decoration on each two cell by the same amount, or I'm decorating the same 2D SPT faces on all the cells of this 3D, on all the surface, on all the faces of this three cell. And this operation actually creates a trivial SPT state, although it looks like a non-trivial decoration because the whole thing is a smooth deformation. So we should model those trivial decorations. And mathematically, they are expressed by the same partial operation, because this procedure is like you assign to each three cell a 2D SPT phase. Or a two cocycle, or a three cocycle, and you add that two cocycle to all the faces on the boundary of in the boundary of this three cell. So that's like you assign this the bulk with you assign a cohomology class to the bulk and add it to the and transfer it to all its boundaries. This is the same operation that we were doing before when we were trying to compute surface anomaly. It's just that the cohomology class is one dimensional lower. So it's given by the same partial operation, which we also define as a D1 operation. So this D1 operation now maps a decoration of P minus one dimensional SPT states decorated on each P cells. And this decoration means the content of this bubble in each three cell. And we would refer that to a bubbling pattern. And this whole thing is we call it a bubbling process, but because that involves creating those SPT bubbles inside of the cell. So at the end of the day, we have a no open edge condition, and one we have a bubbling equivalence, and we should take all the decorations that satisfies the no open edge condition and mod out all the bubbling equivalence, and this actually gives a result of a homology group, and mathematically the result of this homology group calculation is known as the second page result, which represents a finer answer to the classification problem that we wanted to study. Yeah, so I think up to now I can give you some examples. This is one example of non-trivial decoration. So this is actually a spatial decomposition according to this space group number 94. I'm not exactly sure what that is. But imagine you have this space group symmetry and an additional Z2 symmetry. So the Z2 symmetry means that on each two cell, you could decorate a CZX or Levengoo state. And the rule is that basically the edge anomaly is a Z2 classification. So on each edge, you have to have an even number of non-trivial decorations on the two cells surrounding it. And you can show that actually Zhida wrote a computer program to show that this decoration actually satisfies all the consistency conditions and it's not trivial. However, this cannot be deformed into a flat or layer construction. So this is one example of a non-trivial decoration beyond layer constructions. And this was actually adapted from this paper. In there, we were calculating crystalline topological insulator decorations protected by space group symmetries. And there, the Z2 classification is given by 2D Z2 TIs. But you could just change the replace the Fermionic system with a bosonic system and replace the charge U1 and the Z2T symmetry with an on-site Z2 symmetry, and the calculation is the same. So this is also a non-trivial generator for bosonic SPD states. And I should have it here. But the claim is that so far the consideration is enough if the symmetry group is simply a direct product of on-site symmetry and space group symmetries. And we can show this. This consideration is enough if this is the case, and if you are willing to just ignore all the zero-dimensional decorations, which are kind of trivial because they are just randomly, they are just consist of assigning irreducible representations to the point group to all the high symmetry points, which are actually an atomic insulator because they are just zero-dimensional decoration, just assigning zero-dimensional irreducible representations to each point. So if you are willing to ignore those and assuming that the space the symmetry group is a direct product, then the second page result is the final answer, and what I told you now is good enough. And so Zhida wrote a program to actually carry out this computation for all the 230 space groups and in combination with some random choice of on-site symmetry groups. And here's a part of the result. Actually, half of the length of paper is this giant table that lists all the results. This can be done using a computer program. And so I think in the next 5 minutes, I'm going to tell you the more complicated part of this story. So it turns out this is not the final answer if the symmetry group is not just a direct product but some non-trivial extension between this on-site symmetry and the space group symmetries. So I hope this is this could serve as an introduction to spectral sequence for physics. But anyway, so the idea is that this is actually very similar to a perturbation theory in the sense that we consider the state as a summation of lower and lower dimensional decorations. So we start out with 2D decorations, and then we add the 1D, we add the one-dimensional pieces, which we call the connectors. Previously we argued that after we put some two-dimensional decorations, we want to make sure that the 1D edges can be gapped out. But now let's if this is possible, then let's actually put something on the one-dimensional edges and make sure and actually gap it out. And then the next question is whether the zero dimensional cells can be gap out as well. So there's some higher order no open edge conditions. And once that happens, that checks out, we need to fill all the zero dimensional cells and complete the construction. And correspondingly, there are also some high order bubbling equivalences. So imagine that let's start with consider a two-dimensional system, basically because that's easier to draw. So we start with some bubbles in the two cells, and we create some bubbles in two cells and make them grow until they fill the bulk of the two cells. So previously we said that this process will create some non-trivial one-dimensional state on the one cells, but now let's imagine that these two actually cancel each other and results in a trivial one-dimensional decoration. However, they might not cancel each other precisely. And then at the end of the day, it's possible that after you add them together, you get a trivial state, but the state is not exactly zero, or it's not exactly vacuum. So now we need to actually erase this state by just creating another one-dimensional chain of trivial states to actually erase this thing. And after you do this, you end up with some zero-dimensional decoration, which could be non-trivial on each zero cell. So this means that this zero-dimensional decoration looks non-trivial, but it can be created or annihilated by this bubbling process. So it's still a trivial process. But in order to see this, you have to start with bubbles in two higher dimensions. Yeah. So I don't have enough time to explain this, but basically you need to do this order by order. Like previously we checked the no open edge condition in one lower dimension and the bubbling process in one higher from one higher dimension. And you also, in principle, you also need to do that, check the no open edge condition on two lower dimensions and bubbling process from two higher dimensions. That gives you the third page results, and the computation goes on and on. And in each step, the results become smaller because on one hand you could eliminate some false entries that are not actually consistent gapped symmetric states, and on the other hand you are also modeling out some more and more trivial states. So the results get smaller and smaller until at the end of the day it converges to the final answer, which people denote with this infinity symbol. This sounds complicated, but this is actually always a finite process because our space is finite dimensional. So you can only go two or three steps until you hit zero dimensional, minus one. There's no minus one dimensional cell, or there's no four dimensional cell. So this this must end after at most three steps. Yeah. So. Third page is just that we need to, if we start with two-dimensional decoration, we need to check the trivialization on zero cells. And if we start with, if we start with bubbles in two dimensions, we need to check the trivialization to zero dimensions.
Is there a simple way to see that when it's direct, when it's higher pages?
I don't think there's a simple way. So you can actually try to compute this and see that. So the idea is that so the subtlety comes when the anomaly cancels here. If in the most general case, if it's a group extension, then sometimes although they cancel, they don't. That means if you add them together, it's a trivial cohomology class, but it's not precisely zero. But if it's a direct product, then you can show that if you get a trivial result, you can always choose a wave function such that the summation of the two is exactly zero. Then you won't have this problem, because once the obstruction class or the anomaly class is exactly zero, you can choose just a vacuum decoration on 1D, and then that won't give you any problem on 0D, etc. So there's a way to explicitly show that you can always choose a zero decoration on 1D, because we only have a finite number of possible point groups on one cell. That's just basically CN and DN, and we can check that one by one. So I'm not aware of any simple calculations. Because mathematicians, I think, they refuse to give them. Like as long as they set up a special sequence, they consider the problem done. So, and at the end of the day, there's another subtlety called the group extension problem. I'm just going to give some outlines about what it is. Yeah. Yes.
Suppose we are considering a 4 plus 1.
Yes.
Then is it still right if the total symmetry is a direct product? And I can truncate. At which page can I truncate?
I don't know.
Do you expect the answer to be the same as
you? Yeah, I think I would guess you can still truncate at second page, but I don't have a proof.
Previously, you said the reason sometimes you cannot is because if you have a trivial cocycle, but the cocycle itself is about zero, in principle, you can find a gate transformation to make this rule.
Yes.
What's
yes.
the objection to finding such a gate transformation?
I don't know. It's just we don't have a like very organized way of showing this. Like we just check it case by case in 2D. But I can give you some examples. Like in general, when there's a natural extension, this happens very often. That I can give you like results when there is a obstruction, but I don't know how to prove. Like when it's a direct product, then there's no obstruction to that. Yeah. Okay.
By definition, if you have a trivial cycle, you can always find a gate transformation to transform it into zero.
Right. Yeah. Let me skip this let me skip this and talk about this example. I think this example might demonstrate that. Sorry. I'm not skipping anything important. Just some abstract, boring stuff. This example is actually. Adapted from this paper by Ying Zhan and Ashwin et al. So the idea was that, so now we have a natural extension between the on-site and spatial symmetries that the translation symmetry actually don't exactly commute. They commute into a commutator is an on-site Z2 symmetry. And in addition to that, we also have a time reversal symmetry. And so in our version of the story, we were trying to create a two-dimensional SPD state. So here, the two cells is like the squares, and because translation symmetry is not part of the stabilizer group, on the two cell we only have the on-site symmetry Z2X and Z2T. So so naively we could decorate any SPT states protected by this G0 symmetry. So if you do the calculation, the classification is Z2 plus Z2. That means there are two Z2 generators. The first one is the CZX or Levengood, which is protected just by the Z2X symmetry. So this is OK. You can extend it to the whole system without any problem. The second generator is a SPT state protected by both by Z2X and Z2T. So it turns out there's some problem there. So I didn't write down any details. But the idea is that now we want to let me do it here. So we want to decorate something on the two cells. I didn't give the rule of the game, but let me do it now. So the idea is, on the two cells, I'm writing down a three cocycle that is a function of three group elements, G1, G2, and G3, right? If it's a group cohomology class in this cohomology group, then I only need these two group elements to take value in G0. However, this cocycle is not enough if I want to compute the symmetry related decorations on this cells, because this one is supposed to be related to this one by translation symmetry, and this one is supposed to be related to that by translation symmetry. So what I need to do is that I need to extend this cocycle function such that the parameters can accommodate group can take values in elements in the total symmetry group, not just this G0. So let me call that let me denote the group elements in G0 as H, So I would need another cocycle. Let me call it omega tilt, which depends on three group elements in the total symmetry group containing both on-site and translation symmetries. And the problem is now is that I cannot actually find a cocycle function. First of all, I wanted to restrict to go back to this cohomology cocycle function when the parameters are actually in G0. So let me just write. I want it to be the same as omega when I restrict to G0, when I restrict all the parameters to G0. And secondly, I would want this cocycle to be symmetric. Let me write down. Actually, write down the so-called inhomogeneous cocycle. So in the sense that this function is supposed to be symmetric under the group actions, like I should have omega h0, h1, h0, h1, h2, h3 equals to omega gh0, gh1, gh2, and gh3. Sorry, if g belongs to g0, sorry, I should write it as h, but you get the idea. But when I extend the definition to the total symmetric group, it turns out that it is not possible for omega tilde to be invariant under the action of all symmetric group, all group elements in G. It turns out I just can't find such a cocycle function. The result is that if I put a cocycle here, omega tilde here, another thing I didn't tell you is that since these two are related by translation, what I put here should be Tx times omega hat. So I didn't tell you how to compute this Tx times omega hat, but turns out the rule is quite simple. The Tx, this is basically another function which depends on G0 to G3. This is given by just Tx inverse G0. So it's just you multiply each group element by Tx inverse. So if this omega tilde is invariant, if you were invariant under Tx action, then these two would be the same cocycle function. But now since it's not possible to achieve that, then there's some difference between omega tilde and the Tx omega tilde. They still belong to the same cohomology class. That means that the difference between them is still a trivial three cocycle. But you just cannot make it zero. So that's where the problem comes. And once you do something, so you have to put something here to solve this equation, because the declaration here, if I denote it by mu, is like it has to satisfy d mu equals to Tx omega tilde minus omega tilde. Sorry, I should give my computer more coffee. But anyway, so here, this d is the cobounding operation in group cohomology. So if the right-hand side is not zero, but it is a trivial class, that means mu has a solution, but the solution also has to be non-trivial. So you cannot choose a zero solution. Then after you put something here, you have to put the symmetry, the symmetry-related cocycle. And then you see these two are necessarily not the same. And if you actually carry out the calculation, you see there's an non-trivial two cocycle here that represents a Cramer's doublet. So it means that if you try to put some SPD states here, you can get out the one cells, but you cannot get out the zero cells because there's a Cramer doublet there. In their paper, they were doing things in the opposite direction. So they started with a Hilbert space with a Cramer's doublet on each set, and then they argue that you can get it out, but after you do that, you must arrive at this SPT phase. That's a anomaly matching condition. Okay, I think I'm running out of time, so let me just jump to my conclusion. So before that, there's some mathematical statement which I copy from this book. This is a book by Kenneth Brown on cohomology of groups. So they had this theory, which basically says that. So this is the result from Ryan and Thangreen, which is basically saying that there's a concept called an equivariant group cohomology, which is isomorphic to the Euro group cohomology that we consider in SPT classifications. And this one actually classifies the space group, the crystalline symmetry SPT faces according to Ryan and Thangreen. So this book claims that there's a spectral sequence, which is basically what we wrote down before, that converges to this group cohomology, to this equivariant cohomology group. So the subtlety is here, is that here, this so in their version of the spectral sequence, you see both P and Q are on the upper level, superscripts. That means both of them are cohomology dimensions. In our decoration scheme, like physically, intuitively, we want the P to be cohomology dimensions because we want P to represent a spatial dimension. That's a homology instead of a cohomology dimension, especially when we take the boundaries, we are lowering the dimension, not rising the dimension. So that's actually a homology operation. So the difference, the reason that we can, so the difference between this spectral sequence and our spectral sequence is that this X is actually the Poincaré dual of this of our decomposition Y. It's like after this duality, you map 0 cells to 3 cells, 1 cells to 2 cells, etc. So after this duality, this symmetry action becomes different. So before the duality, this mirror would act as an anti-unitary symmetry, and after that, you have a unitary symmetry. That's why this P disappears in this spectral sequence calculation. So there's a nice mathematical explanation about that. So basically, this is our summary. So we developed a way to systematically construct and actually compute this space group a classification of crystalline SPT faces. And so for the simple cases, going to the second page is enough, and that's where we had a program to automatically do that. But most general cases, going to second page is not enough. And especially we have examples, in fermionic examples, even if the symmetry group is just a direct product, it's quite often that second page consideration is not enough. You have to go to higher pages. And so I think in general we can do a lot of this similar cutting and gluing thing for general topological faces protected by space group SPTs. So space for crystalline symmetries. So I think in the future the things we can consider is first the interacting fermion SPTs and also SETs. So you can also think about a two-dimensional decomposition of space and then decorate 2D topological orders to each two cells and try to connect them together on the one cells and zero cells. And you could also even consider a three-dimensional setup and decorate topological orders on the two cells in a 3D lattice and group them together. I don't know what that's going to be, but it seems like an interesting topological faces protected by space group symmetries. And this actually can be used to even simplify calculations for unsized symmetries. There's a work by Meng Cheng and Chen Jiewang. They use this trick to actually convert a unitary Zn symmetry to an n-fold rotation symmetry and compute this classification using this dimensional reduction scheme. There, the computation becomes simpler because originally you started with a three-dimensional classification problem, but after the dimensional reduction, you no longer have any unsized symmetries. So you only need to know how to deal with the classifications in 2D and 1D and 0D. So it's like you can build up the knowledge of 3D classification from the knowledge of 2D and 1D and 0D classifications. And there are some related works. Actually, we learned about the spectral sequence from this paper by Ken et al. So they actually deal with a momentum space classification problem. And also there's a parallel work by Ryan and by Dominic and Ryan. And there's also a related work here. That's all. Thank you for your attention.
Can you go to two slides?
Yeah.
So for this converge, the final answer is actually not necessarily a direct product, but a direct summation.
Yes.
A filtration.
Yes. Yes.
That was the physical meaning.
Yes. Yes. That was the slides that I escaped. I skipped. So the reason I skipped is that we don't have any example for a true group extension at the end of the day. But in principle, this could happen. So let me say this. So for example, if we have two like two-dimensional decorations. So this 2 plus means a two-dimensional, it's a two-dimensional decoration. So here we have some SPT decorations on the two cells, and there are some connectors on the one cells and connectors on the zero cells. So imagine that In this module, like when we consider two-dimensional decorations, when we add them together, it's trivial in this module. That means after we add them together, it becomes trivial on the two cells. So that's considered trivial as a 2D decoration. But the question is whether it's truly a trivial decoration. So once the linear term does not it's not trivial, we only count different classifications according to the leading decoration. That's the filtration we are using. But once the leading term vanishes, we should go to the subleading terms. Like if these two cancel each other, maybe if we are forced to put some non-trivial connector on the one cells, maybe the summation of the one cells is non-trivial. So that means if you add two 2D decorations, you get a decoration that's trivial in two cells, but there's something non-trivial on one cells. So that's a group extension problem. That means when you are, I should have wrote something. When you, at the end of the day, like we are computing this and we were computing the 2D and 1D decorations separately, but when we try to combine them together, this might not be a direct sum between the two. It might be a natural extension, like if this is Z2 and this is Z2, at the end, we might get a Z4 classification instead of Z2 plus Z2. That means sometimes if you double the generator here, it becomes trivial as a 2D decoration, but becomes a non-trivial 1D decoration. So in principle, this can happen. And when this happens, you just need to actually compute all the subleading connectors and see what they actually are after you add them together. So there's a way to procedure to compute this. It's just I didn't talk about it in details because we don't know any like concrete examples where this group extension is non-trivial. But in principle, this can happen.
What examples are in this trans-trivial summation?
Yes. We couldn't find any non-trivial examples.
Let's go ahead and thank y'all again, and those who would like can continue asking questions.
Yeah, sure. Thanks.